Mr. Kahn, you've got 15 minutes. Would you like to reserve any time for a vote?
Yeah, I'd ask to reserve 5 minutes, please.
Okay, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You may begin whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Basil Califf. I'm here on behalf of Derek Lamont Porter. There are two main issues in my opening brief. First was the appellant, was the appellant's properties, specifically his prescription bottle, illegally searched and subsequently seized without any sort of legal justification. And this is the argument that's essentially that my client consented to allowing Officer Parrish to see his prescription bottle and his identification for what was obviously the purpose of matching up the name on the identification to the name on the prescription bottle, but that the officer then went beyond the scope of that consent by checking inside the bottle, by retaining a appellant's identification, and retaining the prescription bottle while asking him questions that were clearly accusatory in nature and sort of showed that this was an investigation for criminal activity, asking about questions about the number of pills in the bottle, and then subsequently calling for backup.
Counsel, can you address the procedural bar issue raised by the common law?
Are you talking about the Commonwealth's assertion that this was not preserved?
Correct.
I would completely disagree with that. I understand the written brief focuses largely on this illegal seizure at the outset, that it wasn't a consensual encounter. But as you see from the transcript, that hearing quickly morphed into this idea that it was an illegal investigative detention without any sort of reasonable articulable suspicion. There was at first some sort of back and forth whether this was consensual, but then it appeared to be conceded that there was a consensual encounter with the officer approaching, waving hello, my client rolling his window down, and that started off as, can I see the prescription bottle? My client allowing him to see the prescription bottle, and then very quickly the scenario morphing from, can I see the prescription bottle, which is clearly a consensual act, allowing the officer to see the prescription bottle, and then it turning into something more, a criminal investigation very quickly. Our position is there was no legal justification for that to happen. So while there may have been an element of consent at the outset, it quickly turns into something else where it's no longer a consensual sort of act, where my client's now being detained and his prescription bottle's now being searched without a warrant, without any sort of...
Where's the evidence in the record of a search of the bottle?
The officer indicates that he matches up the name with the identification. Officer says, that's why I got the identification and the bottle, to make that determination. And that once I did that, I then checked the refill date, sort of did these math equations to see how many pills you would expect to have in the bottle, and then I found that there were only two pills inside of the bottle. So to me, he now has searched the inside of the bottle for purposes of criminal investigation.
Why is it not a reasonable conclusion from the record that he just saw that there were two pills in the bottle?
I would say there's nothing in the record to say, and I don't think there's anything to draw the inference that he looked through the bottle, that it was a transparent type of container or anything else.
Nothing in the record that he opened the bottle, though, right?
I guess the magic words, open the closed container, aren't in the record. But
those are pretty important magic words, aren't they?
I would agree that they're a little more ideal. I would say that, and I would also say that there's a lot of overlap between both assignments of error.
They're very good words that I like that you kind of...
We recognize, counsel, that you get your facts as they come.
I do think there's no excuses on the part of defense counsel, but this morphed from an argument relying on the Moss case where you had this blinding light and someone's effectively seized as a result of the blinding light and they're not free to leave. And it turned into something else, which the trial judge did state, you know, that's not specifically addressed in the written brief, but I then replied, well, you know, based on the information that's come out during the hearing, I now think that we can address this investigative detention type issue. And the Commonwealth says, yes, I'm ready to address that, let's address it. So all parties agree that there's enough notice to the Commonwealth, because the Commonwealth doesn't make any objection to us proceeding on that basis. So what I would say is this scope of consent type argument, it's just simply a product of defense saying that there's no legal justification for what happens after the can I see the bottle portion of the factual scenario that happens in this case. The bottles handed over, the identifications handed over, and then at that point, not only is the officer somehow determining how many pills are in the bottle, he's also retaining both pieces of property, the identification and the bottle, and posing accusatory questions, calling for backup from the Virginia Beach Police Department. And then we sort of get into the second assignment of error based on that. So the first one is his property seized illegally and searched. Well, I wouldn't say seized. It was handed over consensually, but then it was searched illegally. And
he didn't withdraw. I just want to get the facts straight. He didn't withdraw the consent at any point in time.
He didn't withdraw the consent, but based on the Drayton case, yes, an officer can consent for a search, can consent for statements, ask for statements voluntarily, but it becomes a seizure at the point where the individual would not feel free to leave. So officer says, hey, can I look in your pockets? I say yes. They look in one pocket, and then they just start patting me down all over the place. I think that's where the scope of consent type principle comes into play. I don't have to say, hey, you can't search the rest of me, but can I see the bottle in the context of what's in the record? I think it's very clear that this is I want to see the bottle. You got that sitting there in the car. I want to see your identification. And then when he looks at both, I don't think any reasonable person would think that you can then go inside the bottle, call my doctor to verify that this isn't some phony label on the bottle. Yeah, I mean, at what point do we just say that this officer's overstepping boundaries? And I think that happens as soon as he starts doing this math equation and going in the bottle to determine how many pills are in the bottle. So I understand that the record's not 100% clear with respect to how he determined what was in the bottle, but there's nothing about the bottle being transparent or anything like that where a reasonable inference in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth can be taken from the record to say that this officer did some very minimally invasive search of the inside of the bottle. Secondarily, with my other argument, my client was seized based on an illegal investigative detention under facts that simply didn't rise to reasonable articulable suspicion to justify this detention. Taking facts in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, we've got a couple things in their favor. High drug area.
Morphine sitting in his lap and two pills from 90 some odd pills, right? He did the math.
Right.
At that point, I think the way I understand your argument is you're saying once he confirmed the name, that the morphine actually belonged to the defendant, that should have ended the inquiry. Is that your point?
I would say that should have ended the inquiry, because when we look at what basis he would have had to detain my client for, and the record's unclear on this basis because the officer couldn't give it a precise answer. It went from a couple minutes, which we don't know that to literally mean 2 minutes. It could have meant, you know, a few minutes. And my questioning to him was 30 minutes, no less. 20 minutes, no less. Okay, within 10 minutes? Okay, yes, within 10 minutes. And then the number 5 minutes gets thrown around. So somewhere between 2 and 10 minutes that it took for backup to arrive, where my client, I think at that point, no reasonable person would feel free to leave.
Of course, at that point in time, he knew that there were only two pills in the bottle.
He did.
And that it was morphine.
Yes.
And that it's a high drug area. And that he had the morphine sitting in his lap.
Yes.
In a parked car.
I would say that's, and I'm not being facetious about it, I'm saying that's all they had.
Right.
I don't think that's enough. And this thing about high crime area, it's troubling. I understand in a totality analysis, you can always consider high drug area. But, I mean, to say your constitutional standards are a little different on one side of the tracks as opposed to the other, if this type of seizure and search is allowed to stand, when you have, you know, Dolores and Ethel at a hilltop in Virginia Beach sitting in the Oldsmobile and officer comes up and asks her about her pills, why does she have to hold all her pills in one bottle? She doesn't have to. Why would anybody carry 90 morphine pills on them at any given time?
Because they're trying to sell them.
Yes, unless you're trying to sell them. Clearly my client was not, because he only had two.
Let me just point out, counsel, we may very well agree with you about high crime area, but you're going to have to go to a higher court than ours to talk about
and I understand
about that.
With my personal opinions aside, it's still a scenario where you have my client has his pills in the vehicle. Yes, he's in a bad area, the trailer park. And that's about it. And this nervousness issue, I don't think there's much to that. There's no, he had sweat on his brow, his hands were shaking, he made furtive movements, he was looking side to side. It was simply, you know, he was nervous. The other guy was doing most of the talking. And there's nothing else beyond that. So to use that as a factor along with the area, the location where this occurred, and the number of pills in the bottle, the legislature's made no rules about you got to keep all your pills in a specific container. Anybody who's been to CVS or Rite Aid has seen pill containers where you can have your daily pills in a certain, in different containers, Monday, Tuesday.
But there is a little bit of suspicion associated with the fact that they weren't in his medicine chest. They were sitting in his lap in a car parked in a high drug area.
I would agree with that.
And he wasn't taking his morphine at that point in time. He had pill bottles in his lap.
To have pill bottles in your lap, I understand that's an issue, and it becomes an issue, I believe, defense's position is up to the point where the ID and bottle are obtained and you look and you see that, yes, those are his pills. And that's when you get this whole issue of, you know, just because it's a high drug area or high crime area, and the justification for that conclusion from the officer was, I've been to that trailer park and I made a couple arrests in that area. I mean, it's a trailer park. It's the same as it's not like that specific lot is where I saw criminal activity being conducted or if this was a drug house of some sort. Simply, the guy is located in a trailer park, sitting in a car at night. Police approach, and he seems nervous. But we don't really have any basis to say how or that was a result of him being engaged in criminal activity. So.
Well, in counsel, I don't want to get into your rebuttal.
I'm fine with that.
But you're fine with that? Okay. Well, you know, this leads to one of my thoughts here in that this is, a lot of what we're talking about right now are factual points, not so much legal points. And the facts that add up to make the reasonable suspicion. And of course, under McGee and a host of, and Ornelas and all those other cases, we have to give due deference to the trial court on factual findings and to the officer on factual findings, which is why all these Fourth Amendment cases are so factually specific once you get past the legal point. And you make very good arguments. But how do we get past that factual analysis that's done below?
I would say the findings of fact made by the trial court are very limited. It's a finding of fact that, you know, let's just say the officer, everything he said is 100% correct. Nervous guy in a high crime area with his own prescription pills on him. Is that enough to detain him and keep him there for between 2 and 10 minutes while the police backup arrives? I don't even know that we need to touch with a reasonable person. Feel free to leave at that point. Officer has his pills and ID in hand.
Guys, yeah, I don't think the Commonwealth is arguing it.
So, I guess when we narrow it down to what is the issue in this case, it becomes, well, one, the scope of consent thing, but we still think that that's properly preserved in the record based on a number of lines, and they're cited in the opening brief. Are those facts enough to justify an officer stopping a person? And really, again, right side of the tracks, wrong side of the tracks, would the analysis be any different if this happened at Hilltop with somebody else who wasn't a young male sitting in the car? Really, it becomes giving factual deference. Are the proper legal standards met to justify this detention and this search that happens very quickly, a search of the bottle that happens very quickly after the consensual handing over of the bill.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll give you an extra couple of minutes on rebuttal.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson, and I represent the Commonwealth. And we ask that the court affirm this conviction. Here, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to show that, it took me a minute to get my notes settled and I started talking before I was ready.
It's okay, we understand. You didn't write the brief.
My mouth got ahead of my brain. I apologize. Here, there is nothing in the record to show that the officer ever went into the pill bottle itself. There's no description of the bottle. The bottle wasn't taken into evidence. We don't know if it's opaque or if it's transparent. And no one ever testified that the officer opened the bottle and went into it. Here it is just as likely, as was mentioned in a prior argument, that the officer could have just seen through the pill bottle and noticed that there were only two pills. And at that point, when the officer picked up the pill bottle and saw that it was morphine, that it had a controlled substance label on it, he was perfectly reasonable in going further than just looking at the ID, just matching up the names. As far as the defendant's argument that there's no requirement that people keep all their pills in the same bottle, that could be an innocent explanation, but that is not enough to dispel reasonable articulable suspicion. Suspicion doesn't have to be, a reasonable suspicion doesn't have to rise to a preponderance of the evidence. It's simply someone who can reasonably believe, based on his training and experience, that crime is afoot.
Captain, how do you get past the argument that these are pretty slim facts to justify a detention? It is a high crime area. He does have morphine, but it's prescription to him. Mm-hmm. And he's nervous because it's a police officer. And theoretically, lights are shining in on them, indicating that he's being detained. How do you get past all that?
Well, I think that there are more facts in the record than just the ones that the court mentioned, respectfully. The officer also noticed that there were only two pills left in a 90-pill prescription that was filled only a week before. He asked the defendant about the discrepancy in the number of pills, and the defendant's answer really didn't make sense. He said that he took two or three pills a day. The officer quickly ascertained that would mean that there should only be 21 pills missing.
The officer didn't say, where are the rest of those pills, did he?
No, he didn't, but I don't submit that the officer had to. You know, reasonably at that point, he had a pretty good suspicion that those pills were distributed or had been distributed. And that's really all he needed to have. This officer also testified that he had done narcotics arrests multiple times in that area and that there had been several narcotics investigations there. And, you know, kind of regardless of where it is, you did have two adult males sitting in a dark area in a parked car, one of which had two prescription bottles in his hand. With an unusual amount of missing pills. And since the bar for reasonable suspicion is fairly low, that was sufficient for the officer to continue his investigation and to seize the defendant at that point.
What about the delay in time?
There's a very brief delay in time in this case. The officer stated that he walked up and had a friendly conversation with the defendant, asked if he could see his pill bottles. The officer couldn't remember if the defendant said sure, but the defendant handed the pill bottles over. And I believe the officer testified that once he saw the missing pills, he went ahead and called for backup, and backup arrived between 2 minutes was the officer's testimony. I believe the defense witness said 5 minutes. So that's a very short period of time for that kind of detention. And so at the time when the officer called for backup, he knew that he was in a high drug area, which is a factor that we can consider. The defendant had his morphine sitting in his lap. There were only two pills left from a prescription of 90 pills that was filled only a week earlier. And the defendant was nervous, and his explanation of the number of pills didn't make sense and was suspicious. And I submit that is certainly enough to provide a reasonable suspicion for the officer. And I would ask that the court affirm, but I'm happy to answer more questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Kopp?
Please.
We're going to give you a couple extra minutes, so you got 3 minutes and 14 seconds on the clock.
Thank you very much. Just before I forget this, sorry, the last thing that my colleague opposing counsel said was that the explanation of the number of pills was suspicious, and there's nothing in the record to state that. Essentially, the officer says, I started asking him how frequently he uses pills. He said 2 to 3 times a day. And then that's about the end of the inquiry about the discrepancy between what the officer would expect to be in the bottle and what was actually determined to be in the bottle. So there's
But from the record, we know that a week ago there were 90 some odd pills.
We do, but there's no, I guess the assertion that the explanation that appellant gave to the officer was suspicious is not supported by what's in the record.
But did the officer testify that he did the calculations in his head?
Oh, he did, but it's not like my client then made up some excuse that the officer thought, hey, that doesn't make any sense. He was simply asked, how frequently do you use the pills? He said 2 to 3 times a day. And opposing counsel at the trial court level didn't dig any deeper.
Would the officer be entitled to bring his experience to bear in the situations? And, you know, obviously I'm no officer of the law, but I do know based upon my time as a judge that if you're taking that many morphine pills over the course of time that you had the prescription, you'd probably be dead because morphine stays in your system, unlike other drugs where if you take too much, you digest it.
I would say there was also nothing presented by the common law to lead us to believe that this was a morphine pill of a certain milligram amount, or that this was a morphine pill where you weren't supposed to take it 2 to 3 times per day. There's a label on the prescription bottle, or the label on it wasn't introduced into evidence, and there was nothing from the officer to say, well, based on what he said about 2 to 3 times per day, I became more suspicious, or that.
But can't you infer from the record, even in the light most favorable to the defendant, based on his own testimony, that 3 pills a day over a 7-day period equals a lot less than 80 some odd pills?
I do not dispute that at all, but at the same time, there's no law that you got to keep your pills in one spot. And as I said, there's plenty, and it's in the brief, there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to be walking around with 90 morphine pills in your pocket. Sounds fairly cumbersome to be carrying 90 pills. You become a target for somebody who really wants morphine pills, which there are a lot of those people out there. There's no reason, in my opinion, to think that that brings any sort of suspicion to this case. Officers' training and experience, I know they use that term, and that becomes sort of a golden ticket sometimes to say, well, that made me suspicious because I've been trained on being suspicious and therefore I'm suspicious. And my personal thoughts aside on that, there's nothing in the record to say that there was something specific about his training and experience. What was in the record, my client was cooperative, provided his identification when asked, provided the pill bottle when asked. Things that were missing from the case, there's no baggies, there's no scales, there's no money visible at the time of the seizure, no movements, gestures testified to. Nobody in the car appears to be high or intoxicated. So there are a number of things that just aren't there to support what clearly is the Commonwealth's assertion that he had reasonable articulable suspicion to suspect that there's a drug deal going down. And I would ask the court to reverse the trial court's finding.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.